Hey, Josh.
Hey, Nate. How you doing this week?
I'm doing fantastic. I have a new son since the last time that we talked. Little Jonathan is like 2 weeks old now. And yeah, we're pretty excited to have him. So life is good.
Congrats. Yeah, I saw the picture. And my wife makes fun of me because I always make the same joke when I see a baby picture and I say, "We have that hat." You know, like they always wear same, like they always have the same like clothes on in the first baby picture.
Yeah, exactly. How are you doing?
I'm pretty good. I am now officially a coach on the softball team, on my daughter's softball team. And so that's been a ton of fun. I mean, I've been coaching her for pitching for a while, and now I'm coaching all the pitchers and helping out more, but that's been a blast. So
that's fun.
I can get into more of that later, but we have a guest today. We're super excited to have Tyler King, the CEO and co-founder, which I found out, of Less Annoying CRM, a software built specifically for small businesses. And Tyler's been in the SaaS game, at least with this SaaS, maybe he has more SaaS before him, since 2009. Like I alluded to, he's a co-founder and started this with his brother. Is that all correct?
Yeah, that's all right. Thank cool. Good job hitting the points on the intro. Yeah, thanks for having me. And Nate, congrats on procreation.
Yeah, well, thanks.
Yeah, how many do you have, Nate? What's that up to?
Oh, we got four now. Yeah.
Wow. Okay, so you're a savvy veteran at this point.
We're starting our own softball team over here.
Right, there you go. Clearly into the minivan territory. No more like squeeze them into a sedan.
You bet. Minivans are awesome. I'm all for minivans.
I love a minivan. I don't even have kids. And if I don't have a car, if I ever get a car, it's a minivan. They're so, I love them.
There you go. Great. So yeah, there's a lot of topics we're interested in covering today with Tyler, but especially want to kind of drop into the, you know, small business CRM market. Cause, yeah, what I'd like to know first to get us started is, what do you feel like is important to know in that market, Tyler, and how do you think it's changed maybe over the 15 years since you've been in business?
Yeah, so I mean, CRM, I kind of think of it as like the original SaaS market, because Salesforce, I don't know if Salesforce invented SaaS, but they certainly popularized it. And Salesforce started 10 years before we did in 1999. So when we started, I thought we were already at peak SaaS, and it felt very competitive, and it was like, okay, yeah, around the edges, there are some niches you can go after, but it kind of felt like, okay, this is very competitive, and it has just ramped, the level of competition has just ramped up and up and up and up since then, to the point where, like, it's just all consuming. If you say, what is CRM even at this point? I don't know. Is it email marketing? Is it website building? Is it form collection? Like, it's just everything at this point. Sorry, that's kind of a vague answer, but yeah.
It's fine. But I think you're right. Like, I think when I thought I started in SaaS, it was like, it felt later, right? Like, and then you realize as time continues, it's like, oh, there's a lot that can happen. And I'm sure you've seen people creep into CRM from all different angles, from like the project management space, from all these other little, what seem to be, like you mentioned, email, like seem to be tangential spaces. But in the end of it, kind of everyone needs at least a contact database of some sort. And remember the early, was it called ACT?
ACT yeah.
on or some other ones? Like
ACT ones is like the main one
installed.
That, right. I'd say, like, if you're saying, like, what did we replace, it's ACT. I mean, they're still there and they're still bigger than us, but, like, our perfect customer is a former ACT customer. And,
it's
interesting.
Back, it's like Rolodexes, right?
Right, yeah. And we still have, you'd be shocked how many small businesses there are out there still that are, like, our main competitor is probably Excel or something. It's not even another CRM, but. Yeah, I don't know. The market feels mature in a way that it didn't. I didn't realize this at the time, but while we were growing, yeah, there was competition, but we weren't, the market was growing fast enough that if everyone just maintained their existing market share, everyone grew. And the big shift that I've felt over the last maybe 4 or 5 years is that, not that the market's not growing at all anymore, but it's like, if you want customers, you're probably taking them from someone else and they're trying to take the customers from you. It's a much more of like a head-to-head feature comparison type of game rather than like a rising tide lifting all boats type of thing.
Right. Right. Do you think it has, I have a thesis around sort of, especially with SMB, just the the quote unquote digital transformation that people talked about, like for at least enterprises back in, 2000s, like getting to SMB and getting to like more local businesses and stuff like that just took that much longer. Either one of two reasons, they either finally decided to do it or like their kids took over their business or they're like, the people they hired that were younger that are like, you should get into this digital stuff. Like this pen and paper stuff isn't so great. How much do you think that has kind of played into that rise in between?
Yeah, I definitely think I agree. We kind of target, because we're for very, like our focus is on simplicity and really easy to adopt for kind of technophobic people. So we skew older, our customers do. Mm-hmm. As a result, we kind of serve a lot of 50, 60, 70 year olds. That was true 15 years ago. It's still true now, but a 60 year old today is 15 years younger than a 60 year old. So they're all kind of, I wouldn't say they're digital natives, but they're not quite as afraid as they were. And that's definitely part of the shift that's going on. And the pandemic really accelerated that when like everyone had to learn how to use Zoom and stuff like that.
Forced into it.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool.
CRM's interesting because everyone hates using a CRM. It's very much eating your vegetables. So, you get on the phone with a customer and they're like, I have to use this. This sucks. And not that they're mad at us, but they're just like, it's not a thing anyone wakes up in the morning excited to do.
Yeah, speaking of that, I really did enjoy your about page. I know I mentioned I did a little bit of research. Not that I knew about you before and what you did, but just kind of going through and seeing that the timeline there was pretty cool, and seeing that I think your last one, the last major one was a 2023, like kind of big blog post, and you mentioned like how many users you have, and I think at that point it says it's almost 26,000 users. I'm like, wow. Mm-hmm. I'm waiting for the 2024 update. But then,
yeah, I guess I'm going to make a note of that.
you're doing it pretty religiously every year, at least updating it. But are there any specific industries? You mentioned the age demographics and stuff like that. Where you feel like you shine or focus more on from a product perspective?
Yeah. Yes. We're definitely not like a niche down product, and CRM's big enough that there's kind of horizontal products like Salesforce, HubSpot, and we're much smaller, but us. And then there's like the travel agent specific CRM and the really industry specific ones. We're not industry specific, but we've kind of found our footing serving small businesses. Our average account size is 2.5 users. So very, very small, low tech generally. And our CRM, our product is, I would say, less focused on automations and kind of fancy. Like the people listening to this podcast probably are not interested in using Less Annoying CRM. I mean, please check it out and give us money if you like, but probably not the right fit.
Refer your mom.
Yeah, exactly. There we go. But so because we're not so focused on automation and all that, we tend to be a really good fit for businesses that still have a heavy personal relationship component. So like a more transactional business, like retail outlets, or someone who's cold calling a million people and like you either make the sale or you don't right away. That's not our perfect customer. Our ideal is going to be more like a lot of people who use broker in the name, like an insurance broker, a travel agent, financial advisors, consultants, coaches, people who kind of want to maintain a relationship with a smaller number of high value customers. That mm-hmm. tends to be where we fit in.
Do you remember that software Contactually, like way back? It sounds like I know there a lot of their stuff was like automating the relationship parts, like also reminding when to be like, you talked to this person 3 months ago, you probably mm-hmm. should call them or email them. Does it have, is that kind of go into certain cycles with that audience for you?
Sort of. I think Contactually one of the reasons they don't exist anymore, I don't think, is they fell for the classic blunder of trying to be like a personal CRM sort of like. Something like 60 or 70% of our accounts are individual users, but they're individual users using it for a travel agency or whatever. When everyone thinks I want a CRM to manage my friends and family, and it never works. I've seen a million of those come and go over the years.
Yeah, I got an Airtable I used to update that, and then it kind of, goes by the wayside many times and gets outdated. Sometimes I get back into it.
Use my own product I have like a separate Less Annoying CRM account for my friends and family, and I never update it. So what does that say?
Right. What I would say about Contactual, actually, I've met the founder. He's actually local in DC. They ended up, they did go the VC route. So then they also went into, I think they found a niche in real estate, and they ended up getting bought by a big real estate company. So it kind of, they verticalized. And then, like you were talking about niche, you know, like insurance like deep insurance tech, you know, CRM for these niches. And they really niched into like real estate, and then got bought in that cycle.
Yeah, so, that's good. I didn't know the end of the story.
The founder is he's still very passionate about that idea. And I think he's created another one for like a personal CRM database. So
really, yeah.
I don't know how well it's going, but he went the bootstrap route this time.
Love it.
So anyway, another thing I discovered on the page, which I love too, was how you list all your team and how you have the title of CRM coaches and it's like, when did that level of service start for you guys in terms of, I know if you get into the SaaS world of customer success managers, onboarding, but I love that you've named it CRM coaches and tell me.
Yeah. It was a total accident. I think like a lot of bootstrap founder types, I was very much, I mean, I'm a product, you know, coding design type background. And when we started the company, both my brother's the other co-founder, both of us have a technical background. We were like, this is going to be self-serve because we don't want to talk to people, basically. And it's still to this day kind of, it is mostly self-serve. But I just, you know how in the early days, you're just kind of playing business. You're like, I'm going to make business cards. I don't have anyone to give them to, but like, wouldn't it feel very professional to have business cards? So I just put my personal cell phone number on the website to make us look legit. Real companies have phone numbers, especially in 2009, that was true. And then one day it rang and it didn't even occur to me it might be a customer. Like we didn't have customers yet. I was like, this is probably just a number I don't know, like a friend or whatever. So I picked up and I was like, hey, what's up? And the person was like, oh my God, I've called like 20 CRMs. You're the first one to pick up. I'm sold. I don't know anything about you, but I'm going to buy your product because you picked up the phone. And it was just this powerful moment of like, I don't want to do this. And wow, this really works. And so from then on, we just made customer service a huge part of what we do.
That's amazing.
My favorite, if I can tell a little anecdote there.
Yeah, go for it.
A different version of that same thing. I'm a big napper. I take a lot of midday naps. My phone rings while I'm asleep and I'm like, I'm half asleep. I pick up, I'm like, what's up, man? And then it's a customer again. I should have learned my lesson the first time. And he's like, I've been playing around with your software. I really like it. There's just this one feature I want. And this is very early days. And I was like, oh yeah, that's a good idea. I'm still kind of groggy. Like, that's a great idea. Like, I should build that. Maybe we'll build that. And then as I woke up through the call, I realized this is going to be really embarrassing for me to tell you this, but we actually do have that feature. I was just asleep when you asked for it. Yeah, I didn't realize. I was just, my brain wasn't working. And so I had to break it to him. We actually have the thing you're asking for.
That's all.
Anyway, yeah.
Yeah, so like, yeah, I guess did you call them CRM coaches out of the gate as well?
Yeah, good question there. No, the first person we hired was a kind of customer service person so that my brother and I could work more on the product. At that point, you know, that was like, everything's total chaos at that stage of a business, I feel like. And so we weren't thinking about titles or anything.
Sure.
A few years later, when it started like, okay, let's build out a team. And we moved from San Francisco to St. Louis and got an office. That's when we said, let's actually figure out what we want to call these people. Yeah, the customer service has this, it almost implies low quality these days, which is unfortunate. But when a customer is talking to a support rep, they're just like, give me your tier manager. I don't want to talk to you. So we wanted to give a little more gravitas, but not make it seem all enterprise customer success-y. So that's why we landed on coach.
Okay, cool. No, I love it too. And it just kind of goes with that. And you know, let me put you in touch with one of our coaches. It feels better. Right?
Yeah.
So, but speaking, I do want to dip into that. You mentioned about the move from San Francisco to St. Louis. So maybe this is a good time to transition to Nate. I know he has some questions about how you got started and the early days and acquiring customers and things like that. It feels like the perfect segue. So go for it, Nate.
I love it how you're talking about the early days and you're like saying how it's like, oh, it was super competitive back then. Because like, it feels like that today. It's like, oh.
It's worse today.
Well, it's good to know that size hasn't really changed too much. But
yeah.
Maybe you could tell us like where did Less Annoying CRM come from? Like what was the initial spark for that?
Mm-hmm. So I was working at a different startup that was like a health benefits administration. It was like as boring as things can get.
Yeah, I gotta pause you on that because
yeah.
Well, Lewd later, but that was my first like tech job too.
Oh, really?
It was in a software for benefits administration. It was okay. in Maryland, but we'll have to talk about that another day, but just had to just asterisk that right now. Mm-hmm. So. Go ahead.
It's a good launching point, I guess. So our product was for health benefits. We sold it through insurance agents. So basically when an insurance agent goes into a company to sell them insurance, we basically said, why don't you also sell them our software as kind of like an add-on almost? That wasn't the only distribution channel, but that was a big one. And so I built a tool for those agents to put all of their leads into a database. And then when the time came, they'd push a button and it would send the lead to us to like onboard them to our software. And we ended up, I think it cost like $1,000 a month to be a reseller for us, something pretty expensive. And we had a handful of people come up and be like, we have no interest in selling your software, but can I pay the $1,000 a month and keep using this database to manage all my customers? And so I went to the board of directors and was like, come on, like this is an opportunity. Can we build this out? And they're like, no, this just is not the business we're in. And I think they were right. But I was like, all right, well, I'm quitting and going to start this as my own business, basically.
That's amazing. Like, it's like handed to you on a silver platter. It's like, you know, we'll pay you for this.
Yeah. Well, and I listened to your podcast. And I know, Nate, you've kind of been going around from idea to idea in some sense. But like, yeah, I feel like just being out there until the right idea slaps you in the face. I mean, I got very lucky in that happened, but I've never come up with an idea in my life. It came and said, hey, here's an opportunity. You have to do this.
Yeah, but that's
that Futurama thing with it. What is his name? Like where he's like, take my money. Like, I guess, sure. Here.
So how did that work though? Then you transitioned out and you kind of built out this CRM. Like you don't have those connections necessarily to all those brokers anymore, or did you keep some of those connections still? And how did that work?
No, another big difference is like less annoying CRM. It's now $15 per user per month. It was 10 when we started. So like going from 1,000 to 10 also changes the dynamics quite a bit. But I didn't necessarily want to focus on health insurance agents, even though like that we knew there's a market there. But I actually kept working at that company as a part-time contractor to pay the bills while I was bootstrapping up. My brother and I were bootstrapping up less annoying CRM. So I had to be very, very careful not to cross any lines because they were still paying me. So basically just went and started from scratch, and marketing growth type stuff is very much not my thing. Tried blogging, SEO type stuff, got some traffic. None of it converted. The only blog posts anyone wanted to read were not about CRM. The only thing that worked in the early days was Google AdWords. So that's how we kind of got our first group of customers.
Okay, interesting. So you just kind of, did you just kind of try things until you got something that worked, or was there kind of a method to your madness, or?
No method really. I mean, I'd been involved in some of the marketing because my previous job was also a startup. So even though I was a developer, I was doing marketing stuff too. So I kind of had a sense of like how SEO worked, how email marketing worked. I maybe hadn't executed any of it successfully, but I knew the basic principles. So we just tried a lot of it. And then honestly, it took like, I think a year after launch. So this is more than a year after we started the business. I think we had something like $100 MRR. So there was just a very, very long ramp up. And thankfully, I was 24 years old. I was stupid. I didn't know any better. I was just like, I'm just going to assume this will work. So I just kept doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's from what I hear. That's a lot of it, right? Is just sticking it out and just being there long enough to actually get people to know who you are and that sort of thing. I would also just call out too that you continue to work while you are bootstrapping. I think that's an undervalued thing that is like a really stable way to keep money coming in, right? You can probably survived as long and or had as long of a runway without that. That's really cool.
Yeah, because again, I was young, no kids. San Francisco is expensive, but I was living about fairly cheaply by San Francisco standards. If I was working about 20 hours a week and covering all my expenses, so just unlimited runway, right? There was really no pressure for me to like figure something out right away, which was definitely helpful.
That's really cool. So with the AdWords, then did you just kind of scale that up and that just kept going? Like what was kind of you said the first year was 100 MRR. What was kind of the trajectory after that?
While we're talking, I'll pull up my actual numbers so I can be more specific. But the basic, it did start to ramp up. So, okay, here we go. 1 year after launch, we were at 470 MRR, a little better than I thought. That's 47 users. It's easy to do the math how many customers we had. We were at a little over 10 times that. We were at 5,800 MRR after the second year. So like that is both you know, 10x growth is huge, but when the denominator is really small, it's like, okay, well, we're still only making $5,000-$6,000 a month for two people after working really hard and eating into my 401k a little bit and stuff like that. So like middling, but then we were 3x that the next year to almost 15k MRR. Those like year one wasn't great, but years kind of two and three and four were exciting enough that we could really feel some traction there.
That's really interesting, because I think, like, if I think of myself, I would feel like that's like going so slow. I'm like, come on, get me more customers, right? Like, I think it's so easy to get frustrated when you're like, you know, I'm only getting, you know, two or three new customers per week or something like that.
Yeah, you know, there's all this conversation online about like what benchmark do you have to hit to like quit or not quit? And
yeah,
obviously survivorship bias and hindsight 2020, et cetera. But the thing that I can say, there's the numbers. You can look at the numbers and you can say it wasn't working or whatever, but it always felt like it was working. Maybe not that first year, but after that first year, like it's in my opinion, more about the trajectory than it is about the absolute position. It's like, is it getting easier every month to get that next marginal user? And right now it's harder and harder, but at that time it was getting easier. Every month I was just more and more confident. We added another feature, you know, tweaked our landing page a little bit and conversion rates are a little better. Just everything got easier and easier and easier. And as long as I was feeling that, I felt pretty motivated to keep going.
Yeah. So were there like, maybe I'm asking this question too many times, but were there any other, you know, marketing channels that kind of started to take off for you in those first couple of years?
Yes and no. The overall, like if we skip forward to today and look back, the overall message is nothing ever worked. And yet everything combined worked somehow. Yeah. The only other like specific marketing channel that for a while worked was, you know, the Chrome Web Store, which is now like a marketplace of extensions for Chrome. It started not as that. It started as a web app directory. It had extensions, but it wasn't just about extensions. And I saw that, and we were the very first CRM in that marketplace. Like day one, I got us listed because I was just like, this is free. It doesn't cost anything. There was like a year or two there where we were getting a lot of leads, very low quality, very few people converted, but a ton of exposure from the Chrome Web Store. Eventually they just stopped doing the weird web app thing, but that was the only other like notable one. And then I'd say everything else is just, you know, I guess word of mouth. I know that's not a very satisfying answer, but like mixed with, we try SEO and it fails. We're on G2, we're on Capterra. There's all kinds of things we do. I can't attribute our success to any of it, but I'm also not going to stop doing it because maybe they're working in an unattributable way, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Wasn't there one, Rand Fishkin, I think he's got this whole thing about not being able to attribute marketing and you just have to do it.
Yep. Yeah. And we've had a million, you know, after 15 years, we've had a million like, this isn't working, let's do that. And then like a year and a half later, we're like, well, things got worse. I guess maybe that thing was important. So I don't want to act like I had this level of patience and calm the whole time. We kind of flailed around and now I'm a little more zen about it. Like, we just have to do it. That's all it is.
Yeah, but I think that's also like a level of humility too, to admit that you didn't really know what made it work necessarily. Because I think a lot of us don't really know what makes it work. You just, in some ways, you just kind of try and, you know, flounder your way along.
I have a little interesting, you know, potential parallel, but something I've been thinking about a lot about lately. Like you did mention word of mouth, but one thing that is interesting to you or interesting in your case is as you've been tracking, and as you said, it's easy to tell how many, you know, users you had or paying users because it was easy, like divided by 10 at this point. but knowing that, I think you had what it was like year three, it was, you know, 5,000 or something, or something like that, right? So that's 500 customers, right? Is that so?
500 users, so probably
users. But 200 that's where customers. The word of mouth comes from, right? Like it's not necessarily the customers, like paying customers, but it's the users, people using it, and right, and that stuff compounds, right? It's like how, you know, you talk about, you know, healthcare insurance salesperson. You know, they switch carriers, they meet other insurance brokers for lunch. Like that's that stuff that, you know, happens in the, you know, dark social, dark web, whatever, the unattributable space. But what's interesting, I was just thinking about the parallels with Referral Rock and like, you know, we hit that amount maybe in a, you know, maybe in a year after launch, but at the same time, maybe we're charging like $50 a month, you know, per. Mm-hmm. We didn't charge per user, but our count bases were higher. But if you add that up, it's like, okay, but you know, you think about your spinning flywheel after a while with happy users that are getting, you know, personalized CRM coaches, right? Even if you're only selling them, you know, two at a time or three at a time within these, you know, customer bases, but that, you know, level of service and why I think a big reason people refer businesses are because like, hey, this was different because I got treated differently, right? Like you mentioned the phone call, you picking up the phone call. And now you take that as the, you know, I know it wasn't designed this way, but the brand of Less Annoying CRM and Tyler and his brother became this, you know, hey, yep, this individual thing really works. I've heard you talk about pricing and how sensitive you know your customers are and how you know that that's important to them and you make it important to you. And like, those are the things why, you know, people talk about it. So to me, looking at it, it's like, okay, like, yeah, you got new customers through new channels, through AdWords, but that got the flywheel started. And now it's like, okay, now it just has its own perpetual motion on its own. But anyway, so
yeah,
I think it
what's
makes
hard
sense.
About it though. Yeah. And I'm not like a rigorous data science-y type of person. So what I'm going to say is maybe just me saying what I want to be true, but I agree with everything you just said, but what's hard about it is all the advice out there, like the real successful growth people are like quantify everything. And they're like, here's what your payback period needs to be. And don't, you know, your customer acquisition cost should not be more than a third of your lifetime value. And there's all these things you're supposed to do, pricing, et cetera. And like my whole experience has just been, if I had always followed the numbers, I would have shut this business down 15 times over the last 15 years. I'd shut it down right now because nothing's working now. And yet I'm confident 5 years from now, things will be better than they are now. So there's just so much like gut, like I think it's working. And then there's the question of like, well, how much of that survivorship bias? Maybe there's for every one me, there's 99 other people doing exactly what I'm doing and it just doesn't work out. So I hesitate to make this advice, but like what I've done is just, does it feel like people like what I'm doing? Cool. Keep doing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think also the, like the ability to survive it too, right? You've got enough money coming in that it makes sense, right? It's not like you're running a not-for-profit or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So I've done a bit of reading in preparation of this, and I saw you were talking a bit about innovation, which I thought was really interesting because my problem when I start things is I always like to take things back to first principles and come up with some crazy new innovation that generally is like most customers are just like, what is that? So you talked a bit about like innovation and like not innovating too much. And I'm curious if you could, you know, kind of talk a bit about that.
Sure. So I know the blog post you're talking about, but let me answer it in a slightly different way than sure. what you're imagining here, which is, I think a good example of this is we were not Less Annoying Software when we started. We were not Less Annoying CRM. We were Less Annoying Software. And our logic was, we're building this product for people who've never used a CRM before. They don't know what a CRM is. We have to introduce them to the concept. And CRM sounds like an obnoxious business buzzword. Nowadays, everyone knows what it means, but that wasn't true 15 years ago. And so we didn't use you could have gone across our whole site and never said CRM anywhere. It said contact manager, we're a software platform, et cetera. And about a year in, we just abandoned that. Maybe that's part of the reason why our growth actually started working. It became clear, like, we're not going to convince anyone who doesn't either know what a CRM is or like anyone who's not looking for a CRM, we're never going to convince them to buy a CRM. They may be a good customer one day, but they have to reach the conclusion that they need a CRM on their own. There's no way we can make the math work to convince them that they need this thing that they don't need. So we changed our name to Less Annoying CRM and really leaned into it. And we actually, if you look at our marketing site right now, the whole thing is assuming they've already tried Salesforce or HubSpot or something. The whole positioning is, you already know what a CRM does and you know how annoying it is. All we're trying to prove to you is we're not going to be that annoying. I know that's a little different from what you're talking about, but I think that's just an example of like, we were swimming upstream for a while and eventually we were just like, there are already people out there looking for a CRM. Let's just give them what they want.
Right. Well, that sounds a little bit like you first were trying to convince a market, like the wrong market segment, right? Like mm-hmm. you're trying to innovate too much that way.
Yeah.
But
I'm happy to also talk to what you were specifically asking about. You're talking about the innovation token concept and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I stole this from someone else who I think they stole it from someone else too. But a big mistake that I've made throughout, like, especially I'd say the teenage years of the company, like in the early days, you're just a couple co-founders hacking stuff together, doing whatever you can. And then you start building like a business And I don't know if this happens to everyone, but I got a really inflated sense of self-worth and like, I need to be big picture now and yada, yada.
Yeah.
And so I started like solving problems that didn't exist. And so like we came up with all these like internal policies for employees, as well as like things like features for customers, all these things that they were good ideas in theory, I think, but every good idea requires maintenance. Every time you invent something new, you have to convince everyone else that it's right. And as the world changes, you have to change with it, et cetera, et cetera. And eventually what I realized after someone else explained this innovation token concept to me is like, only a few of those innovations matter. Like the fact that we were trying to come up with a new way to offer employee benefits, largely because of my employee benefits background. Every time I wanted to hire someone, I had to have, I'm not joking. I set aside 30 minutes on the call to offer them the job to be like, I have to explain to you why our approach to benefits is good, because it's not going to be intuitive to you. Why is a CRM company, or am I trying to convince someone that they actually want individual health insurance subsidized by the company rather than a group plan? I still think that's the right thing. And it was never worth it. That's not where we should have been focusing. So
right.
This concept of innovation tokens is like, you get three tokens or whatever. There are three things you can do that you have to explain to people. If you limit it to that, it better be important. It's not going to be how you offer health insurance. It's got to be something about your product, something about your marketing, you know, something that really moves the needle for you.
What I like about your explanation of it, and also your side venture onto the marketing bit, is I think that those innovation tokens, like that applies broadly, I think. Like it applies to your health benefits, but it also applies to your code base, and it also applies to your marketing channels, right? It's like, if I'm going to try and be all special and fancy, this is probably going to be a bad day for me. Like if I'm going to go try and make my own database technology, that's not me, right? And yeah, and you've explained the other kind of facets to that too.
I think it's you. You want to create your own database technology.
You can also reverse it though and then say, okay, you want to make your own database technology, come up with a business where that's going to be a differentiator, but it's not CRM. That's not where it's going to work.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and I think that's that for me is a common pitfall. Like I see things like, you know, a slow database. I'm like, a better way to solve this. And, you know, you go down the rabbit hole. And I think it's easy to do that for most things. Yeah. I think that's really cool.
Just to be clear, though, that is wisdom learned through many mistakes. I don't want to act like, oh, I just did this correctly the whole time. I wasted like 5 years of the business on the wrong innovations, I think.
Yeah. Do you have any other examples of innovations you think were missteps?
This may be a little different, but I think we definitely fell victim to premature optimization on the technical side quite a bit. We spent a long time like preparing our database to be sharded, and that was like 3-4 years in, and now we're 15 years in, and we're still easily fitting on like a middle-sized, you know, Amazon Aurora database instance.
Nice.
And it wasn't just the work we spent doing the sharding, but now our database is like half sharded now. And it's just every time we hire a developer, we have to be like, all right, we got to explain this mess of an architecture to you. So there's a lot of technical versions. And then, yeah, I think most of what we did wrong was related to team culture. And we have, I'm very proud of our culture and all that. But also, like, we were just preparing to be a much bigger company than we ended up being. And we were thinking ahead to like, what? Okay, well, sure, we've got one star employee who we should promote, but let's put a system together for how promotions are going to work. It's like, just promote the person and move on. Like, what are we doing here? I just did that type of thing over and over and over.
Classic developer.
Classic like engineering mindset and system mindset, like bootstrap mindset, optimizing, you know, not wanting, you know, for whatever reason, our brain goes like, well, no, I don't want to worry too much about, like, I don't want our server bills to all of a sudden, like, I want to be prepared for that. Right. And it's like, but how much time am I wasting thinking about scaling or microarchitectures or changing the way things are working just to realize I might save $5,000 on it?
Yeah. Right? Well, you know, the midwit meme, like the bell curve where,
yes.
Nate, you're saying, no,
I love that.
Okay. And in case a listener doesn't, like, on the left is kind of the idiot saying something very basic. In the middle is someone smart saying really smart things. And on the right is like the Jedi who really knows what's going on, saying the same thing as the idiot. I'm not sure if today I'm back to being the idiot or I'm the Jedi, but like, I'm trying very hard to make the same decisions I would have made in 2012, not the decisions I would have made in 2016. And I think it's been a couple of years where I've been in this mode, and it seems to be working better to be the idiot in this.
Yeah, I agree with that. I was talking to our product manager, our product designer the other day, and so much of our conversations, and I kind of laugh because we're on like, I'll just give an example of an area. We have this referral landing page that we create for the referral programs. And my very first version way back on this super basic template was like this, not very configurable. You could change a couple options, change the line of text, maybe change an image. Like it was very simplistic what was customizable, right? And all the mid versions like since have been like, you know, like a builder and a drag and drop and all this stuff. And it's funny, we're getting back to like, don't we just want it to be very simple? And they mm-hmm. only have a couple options and the whole like, you know, customers are going to ask you because they want to customize and all this stuff, but you just have to sometimes fight it and just be like, yeah, but really you don't really want that. Maybe mine is ugly and I need a new template, but like I need two variants of the template, but not yep. infinite, like customize it yourself. Like I went the whole other route and, yeah. I totally explained to him. I don't think he heard of that midwit meme before. And I was talking about that. And I was like, yeah. And I think I will, you know, nod to you again to the same thing of, not all my decisions are getting back to those. Some of them, the lights are coming on, and some of them, you don't know when you're in that like mess of that, you know, middle years of overcomplicating the things. But I think it, you know, goes across industry, goes across like how you hire, thinking about OKRs, thinking about all of these different little pieces that we do as we start to feel like we have a bigger business.
Yeah, for sure. I felt that in my bones when you said it.
Josh, I think you had some more things to talk about.
Yeah. The other things I wanted to kind of chat about too was just, I guess other inflection points kind of during, you know, and I think you've talked a lot about a few of them internally, but other ones you can point to, like certain ones that you did feel like you burned 3 years on, because I've got stories for that too, but this is podcast interviewing you, but other ones that you felt like were those, maybe in those, you know, midwit curves and whatnot, but, mm-hmm. you know, other inflection points.
Yeah, I don't think we've had any. If you look at our, like, the revenue number, you don't see any inflection points. It's very, very smooth, like a little acceleration, then a little deceleration to, like, we're not plateaued, but approaching it. But yeah, there have been a million mistakes and successes behind the scenes to kind of create that. I can't say it's an inflection point yet, but I think realizing we want to be on one of the ends of this midwit meme over the last year or two, it feels categorically different to me. Like the whole business feels very different. I think we're going through an inflection point right now, but time will tell. There's a handful of things that are all working together in there. One is really simplifying things, spending a lot less time coming up with policies and this and that, and just being like, we're a 20-ish person company. We're going to be a 20-ish person company 5 years from now. Let's not think about what it would be like to be a 50 person company. So that's been one of the big ones. Another big one for me though has been, so I've seen so many other people make the same mistake, and I'm not judging them because I made it myself too, which is like, I think there's at least three stages. Well, let's call them like childhood years, teenage years, and adult years. That's the wrong metaphor to use here. But there's like, everyone knows the scrappy startup phase. And I think many, many people, myself included in the past, were like, I want to just be a big picture founder. Like the best, what I'm supposed to do here is delegate everything. Be hands off, hire great people, let them do their thing. And just, I'm supposed to daydream about strategy all day. I think the biggest unlock for me is I'm finally coming to terms with, A, I don't actually want that. I like coding. I like designing. Like, I don't have to try to be Mark Zuckerberg. Like, good for him. A, I couldn't be him. But even if I could, that doesn't mean I have to want to be him. But then B, like a 20-person company doesn't need that type of leader. A 20-person company needs, like, CEO is a one-day-a-week job at this company. And by CEO, I mean like big picture, visionary, Steve Jobsy type of thing. So I've gotten like way back more in the trenches, and I've kind of just accepted I am the product and project manager at the company. I think I'm good at that. I think I'm good at figuring out what's the next project we're going to work on. Let's work with the designer, make sure, like, I'm nitpicking every design, and then I'm saying, okay, I'm going to break this 6-month project into 2-week chunks. I'm going to assign the right 2-week chunk to the right person. I'm going to check in with them every other week. I'm not normally reviewing code, but I'm like, I'm testing the things before it goes out. I'm working on the launch announcement. Like, I used to kind of think I have to delegate everything. And now I'm like, I'm good at this. Why am I delegating? We'll see if it works.
It speaks to me about the, I don't know if you've seen the, all the founder mode stuff.
Mm-hmm, yeah. 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 I, half of that I kind of hate. But...
the biggest reason this stuff has been a hit lately is like they said the quiet part out loud. Like mm-hmm. the thing a lot of people have realized coming through that, that curve of like, you know, same thing of like, I should be, you know, what I should be versus who I am, right? And kind of coming to kind of terms with that. The fun thing I like about, you know, you and me in these positions of like the CEO is, you know, I want to believe I am also good at a lot of these things. But then at the same time, it's like, well, does it matter anyway? Even if I'm not good at it,
right.
I'm still the boss. So uh-huh. it's my company. I'm enjoying it. Like, we are still growing. Maybe there's a better way, but doesn't matter. I like doing the thing. I like getting my hands in there, and you know, proof is in the pudding. It's growing. Is there anyone else that could do this and fit into this spot? No, not really. Like, how long would it take to onboard and for them to understand and work with the team? Like, nope. And I like doing it. Problem is kind of solved.
Yeah, and the I like doing it is one of the key parts. So a lot of those other founders that I know that aspire to be very hands off, I will say a lot of them don't like it, and they're like, I'm starting this to make money and eventually exit. And that's totally fine. But my superpower, and Josh, it sounds like your superpower, is liking a thing that many people don't like. And it'd be stupid to turn my back on the fact, like, I'm 15 years in. I'm just as excited about this as I ever was. That's my big advantage. I'm not smarter. I'm not better at coding. It's just that I can do a boring thing for 15 years. That's what I've got. So I should be doing.
Well, and also you've got the history with the company, right? You know the customers mm-hmm. probably a lot better than a lot of other people too, right? So like deciding which projects are more important and that sort of thing, like that probably is actually something you're good at deciding.
Yeah, yeah. The value of context is something I definitely underappreciated. I did the thing I talked about where like I hired a really good software engineer who like super successful at big tech companies. Like he's great. I hired him in the early days and was just like, and he's one of my best friends from high school. I also know him very well. I was just like, you're better at this than me. Do whatever you want. And it just failed miserably. The fact that he's better at coding than me doesn't change Nate. Like you just said, he didn't know the customers. He didn't know the strategy. He wasn't talking to any of the other people at the company. This is my fault, not his. I didn't put him in a position to succeed. I was abdicating responsibility rather than delegating. And so I'm trying to realize delegation doesn't mean you, the founder, aren't still responsible for the outcome. It just means other people are going to help you do the work. And I'm kind of coming to terms with that now.
All right. Cool. I think we covered a lot across the base. This was honestly a ton of fun. Just, you know, learning about you, learning more about your business, and also just all the parallels are really fun as well. Yeah. I don't know. I hate asking the lame questions at the end, but it always helps the wrap up anyway. The one I had two in here. One was like, any regrets, things you know, you would have done sooner that, you know, if you knew what you knew now, but I feel like we've covered so many of those. So it's like, that's sort of the whole, you know, midwit thing.
Yeah. There's the midwit thing. I'll give a different answer. Like, that's the big one, I think, is overcomplicating okay. things. But I think the other kind of like more high level regret I have is I didn't know what I wanted out of the business. And to some extent, that's because I was 24 and I didn't even know who I was yet. Now I love where we're at. We're a small bootstrapped business. I work with a great group of people. Many of my best friends are my colleagues. 2 days a week in the office, which for me is perfect because like enough seeing people, but not taking over my life. This is where I want to be, which is great. When we were 1, 2, 3 years in, I thought I want to be a billionaire. And I made a lot of decisions, and especially I made a lot of commitments to people I brought on. And like I hired people with the like, well, here's how the math's going to work out when we're making 10 billion ARR, right? Mm-hmm. A, like we probably would have failed at that anyway, but B, now I realize I didn't even want that. And the hardest parts of the business have been undoing commitments that I had made to people when I never needed to make the commitment in the first place. I could have just hired them and been like, let's have some fun and see where this takes us. But instead, I just made people expect a thing that never ended up happening. And unwinding that was a real pain and very emotionally difficult. That's one of my big regrets.
Yeah. It seems like there's an underlying theme we've kind of mentioned too. It's just like, if you listen to the things on the internet, on like yeah. startups, VC backed, like all these sort of like, and I don't blame it. Like without that information, I don't know if I would have started a startup, right? Like it's sort of, you get the good with the bad. Now, how many other things did I make similar decisions and thinking about how this was going to turn out and made them in different ways? And now that I feel like, you know, you see all these founders running into trouble or running into like little, you know, just stalls and whatnot or burnout or whatever, because they've followed some of these things to a T without figuring out what they ultimately wanted, right? So I can't fault it, but also sometimes you kind of point it and you're like, man, I wish that advice was not out there. Like, you know, or compare, you know, same thing with the indie hacker. It's like you see and people's growth rates and things like that, or, you know, of course the build in public, you're mostly sharing the great stuff. So you only see that. You're only going to see the great stories, and it looks like a rocket ship trajectory. And then internally, when you're at $100 MRR at the end of a year, and you're like, this feels like I'm nothing. You know, it's like, that's not true either, right? It's not anywhere. But
especially like, are you having fun? Then great.
Yes.
Good for you.
Right. So hopefully with the podcast listeners, you're listening to this stuff. This is the fun, more interesting things. And, you know, if you are listening, then you're probably get our vibe anyway.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to hear more from Tyler, where can people find you?
So I have a podcast very similar to this one called Startup to Last, startuptolast.com. And then, my business is lessannoyingcrm.com. And I'm on Twitter for as long as it remains viable.
Perfect. Awesome. Thanks a lot for coming on, Tyler.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was fun.
Hey, thanks for joining us today. If you want to chat with us, we're on Twitter. I'm at Nate Bosher. And Josh is at JLogic. If you're a new listener, check out some of our most popular episodes. Episode 52, 7 years to 22 MRR and zombie startups. Or episode 30, review sites are a necessary evil and hacks to get around them. Thanks again.